Welcome to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan, sitting in for Mindy Todd. She's away at a public radio conference and will be back next week. In 1920, the 19th Amendment was passed, guaranteeing women the right to vote. 96 years later, a woman has become the presidential nominee of a major political party for the first time. It's a historic moment for the country, but is it a big moment for feminism? Earlier this year, a Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll found that 6 in 10 women identify as feminist, while about a third of men do. In the same poll, 50% of men and 43% of women say they do not identify as feminists. What does it mean to be a feminist in 2016, and why are so many people rejecting that label? A bit later, we'll be joined by theologian Mary Hunt and former State Senate President Therese Murray. Right now, joining us in the Woods Hole Studios is Brenda Lone Baker, a certified professional coach who helps people with their professional and personal lives. She runs Inner Ovation with her husband, George Lone Baker. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And joining us on the phone, Angelique Roche, the Director of External Affairs for the Ms. Foundation. Welcome to The Point.
Good morning. How are you?
Hello, good morning. Angelique Roche, the Ms. Foundation might be the most prominent feminist organization in the country, founded by Gloria Steinem in 1972. I'm sure the foundation is aware of the large number of women who are hesitant to call themselves feminists. Why do you think that is?
Yes, actually, and ironically, we did do a survey last year in regards to this, looking at the label, and a lot of it is misunderstanding. As with many equal rights movements, labels, there's always propaganda, there's always misunderstanding, and as you know, there's been the ever so present, if I'm a feminist, I hate men, which is clearly not the thing, or, you know, much like the suffragettes, the propaganda that was put on by women who are looking for the right to vote, right? Obviously, if they were looking for the right to vote and they were looking for the right to have equal rights as men, then clearly what would happen to the American home? And so this has been something that has really been propagated. But one of the things we did find in that same survey, we asked three very specific questions. We asked, do you consider yourself a feminist? And I won't even say, our numbers were actually a little lower than the numbers that you mentioned. But we took a step back and we said, do you believe in the social, political, and economic equality of all genders? And it overwhelmingly jumped because we asked really basically, do you believe that women should have the equal rights as men? And at that point, there was an overwhelming majority of people who absolutely agreed in the fundamental definition of feminism, even if they didn't actually associate with the label of feminism. Hmm. And so the work we're doing at the Ms. Foundation is actually taking a step back from labels and really looking at what is the core of what the spirit and the ideology of feminism. And there is a lot more people in the country that are more aligned with the core spirit of the definition, even though sometimes the label brings about some of the very strong, very ingrained stereotypes that have been created around the word.
And I should mention that the Oxford English Dictionary defines feminism as the advocacy of women's rights on the ground of the equality of the sexes. I am going to turn to Brenda Lone Baker. You've said that one of the core questions you ask women in your work is to define success. It can mean different things to different women. Is there room for different definitions of success in feminism?
I definitely believe there is. I think it's funny. I think feminism is one of those words like success that we all have this vision of what it is, which really doesn't fit all people. And, you know, I've found working with women that, you know, everybody's vision of success for them can be different. And a lot of it is really clouded with this definition that we've been brought up with of what that's supposed to look like. And so having people be able to get clear on what they really want. So I definitely think there's room for anybody's vision of success and what that means to them.
Angelique Roche, how do you think the definition of feminism has changed since the 60s and 70s?
Well, I think there's a really strong understanding of painting what a feminist looks like, right? One of the things we actually did last year as well, and this is just riding on the evolution, is that we brought in folks from the ages of 17 to 81, and we asked them what feminism means to them. What does their feminism look like? And I think there's a lot more room with self-identification, with sexual orientation, gender identity, that allows people to really look at what, again, very similar to the idea of the different views of success, what does equality look like to you? Because women live very complex lives and have very complex issues, and they're not just fighting for equal rights for them, but for equal rights for their entire community. And so the evolution, with the evolution and changing demographics in America, as well as we're now living in a country where when feminism started, many women weren't able to get mortgages. They weren't able to take out credit. They were still working very junior jobs. And we've seen a lot of progress. You know, you've seen more women in C-suites, and equality is the idea of equality has to progress forward as progress moves in that direction. And so I believe now when people really think about equality, there are changing circumstances, and with that, feminism has evolved.
This is a question that I'd like to put to both of you. In this poll that I cited, 4 in 10 Americans see the feminist movement as angry. That was a word that was used. And a similar portion say it unfairly blames men for women's challenges. Brenda Lone Baker, what do you make of that?
You know, it's really interesting because that's part of that whole definition piece of feminism. And what's really happening out there is there has been all of this movement forward, and there are companies that are creating leadership programs for women. The problem is that some of them aren't taking it that next step and including men in it and helping the men know how to create female leaders as well. And although some of the companies have these great programs that help women know how to be leaders, those same companies aren't pushing women forward and allowing them the leadership positions once they've completed that education. So I think it really is something that involves women and men and everybody working together.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to take a shot at that, Angelique?
You know, I absolutely agree. But I'd also add in, we have seen a rise in the fact that there are a number of men who are self-identifying as feminists now. Matt McGorry, Wade Davis, Patrick Stewart are all coming forward, setting the example. And, you know, I see it as the movement continues to progress forward into third wave feminism, that there is an open door now for those and anyone who agrees with that definition to come to the table.
Let's bring in a spiritual and religious perspective into the conversation. Joining us on the phone is Dr. Mary Hunt, a feminist theologian and co-founder and co-director of the Women's Alliance for Theology, Ethics, and Ritual. The acronym is WATER in Silver Spring, Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be with all of you.
Mary Hunt, most organized religions follow a fairly paternalistic model. You've got God the Father at the top, followed by men in positions of authority. Women historically have been in supporting roles. How do feminists find a home in religion?
Well, with great difficulty, I would say, in most instances, but with increasing success, if we're using that word this morning. The patriarchal structures of organized religions are well known, and I think patriarchy can be kind of an abstract word for a lot of people, but the three elements I'd look at are the top-down teaching and organization, the elite leadership, and the lack of shared decision-making. And I come from the Catholic tradition, so I know that close up. And I think that efforts at changing those structures have really been successful in many religious traditions, but with some provisos, and we can certainly talk about those.
How has feminism changed religion?
Well, you know, in the late 19th century, when the suffrage movement was getting started, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her revising committee put out a book called The Women's Bible, and they literally looked at the Bible itself and asked questions about how various verses in the Bible had been translated and how they were interpreted and how, in fact, they were preached. And they said, wait, we want to look at this. And as I often say, maybe the Bible should have a warning label like a cigarette package. You know, this book could be dangerous for every woman's spiritual health. And that has led to a great deal of critique of how images of the divine, of God or goddess, how male savior figures like Jesus and so forth have really given women second-class citizenship in most religions. And yet, women have begun to study religion, to deconstruct a lot of those ideas, and to propose new ones. Women have also moved into religious leadership in a lot of circles, not in all by any means, so that there are some real changes going on in the religious world, and certainly the challenges, especially to symbols and images of the divine. So the Godfather, Lord, Ruler, King, Santa Claus, white male God, simply isn't normative for most women anymore, and certainly not for a lot of men either. And that's a real step forward.
For many years, the gender equality movement sought by feminists has been along male-female lines, but those lines have become more blurred as gender identity becomes more fluid and nuanced. How does the LGBTQ community factor into a discussion about feminism?
Well, I think that's one of the great advances in our time, namely that we have moved from the binaries of male and female, of masculine and feminine. We've come to understand the wide range in which people understand themselves, both in terms of gender identity and in terms of sexual orientation. This means that what started off as kind of a one-dimensional male-female problem, as it were, has become like a three-dimensional tic-tac-toe game, where we really have to understand not only the ways in which gender identity and sexual orientation figure in, but also issues of race and class and education and nationality and physical ability and so forth. All of these are a very complex analysis, or what we call an interstructured analysis, for helping us to understand the human condition in an increasingly complex world and taking into account animals and nature as well. So we've really moved from a gender-based understanding of feminism to feminism, in my view, being a way in which we talk about inclusive ways of thinking and acting.
In June this year, the Pope said he would create a commission to study whether women can serve as deacons as they did in early Christianity. Is this a sign of things to come?
Well, I'd be careful about it. I think while it looks like a step in the right direction, it's still the Pope saying it, which means the top-down structure hasn't changed. And even this Pope, who many people like very much, because he's so admittedly so much better in his, at least in his public relations than the previous two popes, nothing really of substance has changed for women in his pontificate. We still have the ban on birth control. We still have the ban on abortion. There are no women priests. And most importantly, there are no women making decisions. So to have women deacons, which this six women and six men commission will study, isn't really going to make a big difference in my view. It's not clear that the decision will be to make women deacons, and if it is, it's not clear that they'll be deacons in the way that male deacons for ordination to priesthood are, namely deacons on the way to priesthood, which is the place, which is the role in which one can make decisions. So simply to create women deacons to do more service without decision-making seems to me a step in the wrong direction.
You are listening to The Point on WCAI. Do you call yourself a feminist? Do we need the feminist movement anymore? 866-999-4626 is the number to call to join the conversation. We've been talking with Mary Hunt, theologian and co-founder of the Water Program. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And on the phone, we have We have Angelique Roche of the Ms. Foundation, and in studio, Mary Lone Baker of the Inner Ovation Company. Coming up, we'll talk with former State Senate President Therese Murray. That's after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan. We're talking about what feminism means today. It's a term with a lot of baggage. 43% of the people polled by the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation said that angry was a word that described feminism in the United States. On the other hand, in the same poll, 70% of the people said that the word empowering describes feminism. So, mathematically, at least of the few people believe that feminism is both angry and empowering, which is interesting. It's been a big year for women in politics, and we want to bring in former State Senate President Therese Murray to talk about the intersection of feminism and politics. Therese Murray, welcome to The Point.
Thank you. Good morning.
You reached arguably the most powerful position in state legislature, becoming the Senate President in 2012. What were some of the challenges of being a woman in that role?
Well, first, I took the presidency in 2007.
Oh, sorry about that. 2007. Okay. Something pivotal might have happened in 2012, but 2007. Yeah. So what was challenging about that position in that hadn't been held by a woman, at least in recent memory?
It's never been held by a woman. I'm the first woman to hold that position. Mm-hmm. And we've never had a woman Speaker of the House. So I would love to have women follow in those footsteps sooner rather than later, but I think it's going to be a while. It's a difficult position anyway, whether you're a man or a woman. It's a little bit more difficult as a woman because people still don't see, and they're not used to, particularly in Massachusetts, where we're not that enlightened in some areas, that women would have the leadership role. And frequently, when I would meet with maybe heads of, prime ministers or things like this from other countries or councils general, or business people, they'd come in and they would go directly to my chief of staff, who was a man, and shake his hand and not expect to be seeing a woman in that role.
Hmm. How would you define feminism today?
Well, it's definitely changed since I was younger and ran City Women for Action, which was equal pay and 9 to 5, which also was equal pay. I think that the term then was we were coming out of a big revolution, a political revolution in the late 60s and 70s, and women who were part of that political revolution were saying, well, wait a second, how about us? Why aren't we getting the same treatment as our male colleagues who were questioning government and questioning government's actions? And even our male counterparts who we work with for social change, we weren't treated the same. So we kind of looked around and formed groups and met and said, you know, how can we move forward with equal rights and the Equal Rights Amendment and the move to try and get an equal rights, a federal Equal Rights Amendment, as you know, failed to pass in all the states. And it was a woman who was part of the thwarting of that, Phyllis Schlafly, who has recently passed. So not all women believe that women should have equal rights, political, social, or economic. And that was always surprising to me growing up in an all-female family. I have four sisters, and my mom and dad never treated us as if we couldn't do anything. We were always, you know, just let to reach whatever highest standard we wanted.
So let's turn to national politics. Earlier this month, Matt Lauer of NBC's Today Show did 30-minute interviews with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump back-to-back. It was seen as a dry run for the debates, which the first one happens Monday. But Lauer's interviews were called unfair and even sexist in the way
appalling.
That
his interview was appalling. I have watched them for years. And, of course, what has happened to all the women who have been co-hosts with Matt Lauer? Go back and take a look at that.
Well,
they didn't fare so well once they started getting to be more popular than Matt. Matt stayed, they left.
I want to play a little piece of tape so that we get a little taste of the interview. So here is the tape of Matt Lauer and Hillary Clinton.
To exert the kind of pressure through sanctions that the United States alone could not do.
Right, but you said that you think you're going to cheat.
This is an important issue. We don't have a lot of time.
I want to get to a lot of questions.
I will talk quickly.
So, Therese Murray, is that sexism?
Yeah, it is, and it's even worse because I saw when he did the part when he had Trump on afterward, he let Trump talk right over him, say whatever he wanted, didn't challenge him at all, which is what the media has been doing, and yet he kept telling Hillary, make it short, and he kept talking over her. It was so rude. And it was just so appalling, and I'm just surprised that he didn't get more negative feedback from that.
Hmm. Angelique Rocher, did you want to jump in on this conversation? Any reaction?
You know, it's actually one of the things that we've having a very strong conversation about this, right? It's a lot of people are so accustomed to seeing this type of behavior, and it's actually kind of detrimental because I believe you're absolutely right. It is rude. It is sexist, and it is something that generally would not be acceptable if it was a man. And if you really pay attention to a lot of the debates, not just this debate, not just Lauer. This has actually been going on throughout the Democratic debates that were happening earlier this year and last year, where there was a completely different treatment, not just by the moderators of the debates, but a completely different treatment in the press on how the descriptions were on how Hillary was talking, her responses, asking maybe if she smiled more. And this really is sexist. But it is something that's been so ingrained, and it's something that we're so accustomed to in our culture that this is when you get the description of feminists being angry, because people feel as though they're crying wolf because sometimes they don't even see what's happening in front of them until it's made so blatant that they understand that this is something that women deal with every single day, not just in the C-suite, not just when they're running for president, but every single day in leadership positions. Of even how studies done by the Harvard Business Review, that there is a different treatment on the tone and the actual pitch of women's voices when they're in meetings. I absolutely agree.
Brenda Lone Baker here in studio with me. Have you faced this kind of thing when in your coaching?
I definitely have faced this with people, and I agree with Ms. Roche, from all levels, you know, from the household up to the C-suite and beyond. And I really agree that it's this thing that it's been happening so long that it's become normal for us, and we don't recognize it as a problem or disrespect anymore because it's so commonplace. And the change that needs to happen is to make it less commonplace and really point it out, as she was saying.
866-999-4626 to join our conversation. In case anybody thinks that sexism has only been raised with Democrats running for office, let's remember that Carly Fiorina was running for the Republican nomination for president. Here is a clip from CBS News from 1 year ago when Fiorina was still in the race.
In a Rolling Stone interview, Trump said this when watching Carly Fiorina on television. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that, the face of our next president? Adding, I mean, she's a woman and I'm not supposed to say bad things, but really, folks, come on. Are we serious? Fiorina addressed the issue on Fox's The Kelly File.
What do you take that to mean? Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
I have no idea. And, you know, honestly, Megan, I'm not going to spend a single cycle wondering what Donald Trump means. But maybe, just maybe, I'm getting under his skin a little bit because I am climbing in the polls.
Therese Murray, what do you make of the Trump statement and of Fiorina's response?
What do you make of anything he says? He's so outrageous, he can just say whatever he wants. And his treatment and his attitude toward women is amazing. And in case you haven't noticed, we haven't seen his wife on the campaign trail since the blooper at the convention, and then found out that she had lied about her degree and from college.
But how about
it on her website? So
yeah.
She's become invisible.
What about the Fiorina response? How did she handle that?
Well, you know what? What are you going to say? I think she did a good job in responding to it, because if she had done anything else or gone any further negative, she would have been, this is typical for a woman's response to things like that. By the way, the smiling thing, I got that all the time. Well, you don't smile. You should smile more. I'm in a serious conversation about business, and people would just go off and say you should smile more when you're thinking and you're trying to get to a point where you're understanding something that people are presenting to you, and instead they're
asking you to smile.
You know,
right?
As having a real brain.
Yeah. Angelique Roche, did you want to respond to how did Carly Fiorina handle that?
You know, I think she handled it very well. We talked about the whole quote-unquote angry feminist stereotype, and sometimes there is a point to call it out, and sometimes, you know, there's a lot of things that come out of a lot of politicians' mouths. I work for C3, so I'm going to try to be very nonpartisan on this, but, you know, there's been some very troubling sexist things that have been said during this entire election. And, you know, sometimes you have to take it in stride and move past it and not give energy to it. So
I think she knew exactly what he meant, and then she just wasn't going to give it any time and any airtime, and wasn't going to give him any additional earned media airtime.
Mm. Brenda Lone Baker, did you have a reaction to that tape?
I think she did a good job of not getting in the boat. Mm. I think that's always a key play to, you know, not lower yourself to someone else's negative energy, but to respond in a positive way without being aggressive. So she did a great job of not getting in the boat with them.
Women in politics face a lot of the same challenges as women in business. Let's listen to a clip from Bloomberg News from last September when Yahoo made a business announcement about a spinoff company. This was actually before Verizon bought Yahoo, which you might recall happened in July. You'll hear Scott Galloway, a professor of marketing at the NYU Business School, talking about Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer.
I think Marissa Mayer is the most overpaid CEO in history right now. Right? You have a CEO who's made some of the worst acquisitions in the history of tech, senior-level hires that have cost in excess of $100 million in some instances for departures. In my view, and this is going to fill up my inbox this morning, if she hadn't announced she was pregnant with twins, she'd be out of a job within 6 months.
You're willing to say that? That's a serious statement. You're willing to say that?
I don't think any board in America right now in technology that's as visible as Yahoo wants to be seen as not leaning in.
And of course, Lean In is the title of the book by Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg. It was all about challenges women face while working. Therese Murray, have you heard comments like this before?
Of course I have. I heard that all the time. And when I became president of the Senate, was challenged by two of my male colleagues immediately on votes because they didn't think that I should be there. And I won both votes, but one of the members left shortly after that. But that's not uncommon.
Hmm. A sociologist at Stanford University told NPR that there is a double standard when it comes to women leading companies. She points out that men fail all the time, but when women do, it carries different implications because there are so few women CEOs. And it's only about 4% of Fortune 500 companies that have women CEOs. Angelique Rocher, did you want to add to that?
You know, I think it goes and begs the question, you know, had you ever heard anyone say, you know, if he didn't have four kids at home and he wasn't going through a divorce, then maybe X, Y, and Z, he wouldn't have gotten fired and had that a beautiful golden parachute. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen. And I think, you know, there are times where although women don't have the autonomy to make the decisions over their own bodies in most states, for some reason our bodies do control the decisions and the images that people have about us, because he immediately went to the fact that she was pregnant. There was absolutely, there was like literally a straight beeline because that identified her. That was the most identifying factor. And again, that goes to something that we are very conditioned to in our society, is that women are reduced down to their ability to have children.
Hmm, interesting. Brenda Lone Baker here in studio with me. How do you counsel people around career advancement? Is it the case that, you know, you get pregnant and you fall from the promotion ladder?
I don't know that that's always the case. I think it really depends on where you work. And I think for me as a coach, it's really about what the person is looking for themselves and what their values lead them to want. And a lot of women, even internally, have these values collisions because on one hand, they want to be a really great mother. And on the other hand, they want to be their vision of successful. And those two things don't always play well together. So it is a struggle.
866-999-4626 to join the conversation. Let's go to Penelope in Falmouth. Penelope, you're on The Point. What's your question?
Thank you. I think all of the information that's been shared is wonderful, but I would like to point out there are a lot of local things that are happening here in Cape Cod that are working to improve the lot of women. We have the Cape Cod and Islands Commission on the Status of Women holds hearings to hear what women's concerns are. The Cape Women's Coalition is a group that is solely formed to encourage women to participate in civic life and get elected to office. And we have a group called Falmouth Swift, which is supporting women in financial transition, which is a volunteer group designed to work around issues of women's economic insecurity that result as a result of not having equal pay, fewer people having pensions and everything. And we're having a roundtable this afternoon at the Falmouth Library with a wide array of speakers and HR representatives to talk about older women's economic employment issues.
So lots of local work on this issue. Angelique Roche, do you see lots of positive things happening around the country?
Absolutely. I truly believe that right now, and you mentioned it earlier about the evolution with gender identity. I'm using that as a prime example because that's one of the reasons that the Ms. Foundation, we have a working definition of feminism as the political, social, and economic equality of all genders. And so all around the country, and I will tell you, we have 80 grantees, and this is how we really know that the work hasn't stopped, and that work in reproductive justice, economic justice, and safety. And every single day, these grantees are on the ground in organizations that are 2 to 20 folks strong, working on trying to find progressive solutions, but also truly working for full equality for all people in a very nuanced way. Because something we learned in the 43 years of what we've done, and exactly what the caller was mentioning, is that it's the people on the ground, it's the women on the ground and women-led organizations that really understand what the solutions are. They understand what the impact really is. And so that's one of the reasons that we provide support and have provided support for 43 years in innovative solutions, because things are happening. But I will say it does still take national support. And it takes a lot of people really opening the door and setting the table for things like that to continue.
Thank you to Penelope in Falmouth. You can get in on the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Therese Murray, did you call yourself a feminist while you were in state legislature? Was that a taboo term?
No, I just didn't even think about that. I didn't have time to think about things like that. I instead worked on things that issues that I had always worked on was equal pay and a livable wage, which I did just before I left, upping the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Always worked on children's issues, started the Catastrophic Children's Relief Fund. So I put my energies into more of the human services parts of the budget on a regular basis, even when I first began as a freshman, and right up through my presidency, and of course, they took the vote to the Constitutional Convention for gay marriage, and as you know, we passed that in 2007, right after I became president. No one wanted to really take that vote, I just acted. I act what I am, and that's what I am. And when you get this angry old feminist or the anger on it, I get that but I think that goes back 30 years or 20 years or, no, 30 years or more. Feminism is acting on who you are. You want equal rights for not only yourself, but political, social, economic equality for women as well as men. For everyone.
Yeah. I want to get back to this age gap when it comes to feminism. In the poll that I've cited, the biggest percentage of women who call themselves feminists falls into the age group of 50 years old to 64 years old. In that group, 68% of the women polled called themselves feminists. For comparison, 63%, so not too many percentage points lower, of women ages 18 to 34 identified as feminists. And this is what interested me the most. The percentage actually drops for the age group of 35 to 49 years old. So we've got these bookends of you know, the young people and people over 50 saying they're feminists. And then right in the middle, we've got this generation that doesn't want to be called that. Angelique Roche, what do you make of that?
So that is Generation X, and it's very interesting. It is a part. There was a dip. There was a sincere dip, and Rebecca Traister actually talks about this in her book, All the Single Ladies. Where growing up as a Generation Xer during that time, it was hard to be a feminist. Ironically, though, that was one of the first generation that grew up with feminist parents. So it's just a very interesting dichotomy that was created. This is also the same generation that took a huge leap away from religion. So I don't, from what I've seen and what has been talked about, and I'm not going to even try to, like, put in the brilliance of Rebecca Traister, and I recommend everyone read her book. But there was a movement away from self-identification at all. There is, again, as I said, there was a huge drop in religion, but it was that is that Generation X 90s, even I would even say there were less children actually born in that part of generation, in that part of Generation X as well, and there wasn't another boom until we got to millennials. And so I think there is a lot of variables and a lot of dynamics that go into the hesitation to self-identify as almost anything for that generation.
866-999-4626 to join the conversation. Joining us now, actually, let's take a break. This is The Point on WCAI. What is the point of feminism? You can join the conversation. We've been talking with former Massachusetts Senate President Therese Murray. Therese Murray, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and I'm going to listen to the rest of the show.
Great. In the studio, Mary Lone Baker of Inner Ovation, and on the phone, Angelique Rocher of the Ms. Foundation. Coming up, we'll talk with Valerie Bassett, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts. That's after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan. We're talking about feminism. What does that word mean to you? Do you identify as a feminist? You can call us at 866-999-4626. In a poll out earlier this year, 35% of women said the feminist movement is not focused on changes they want. Listeners, what do you make of that? We're talking with Mary Lone Baker of Inner Ovation and Angelique Rocher of the Ms. Foundation. And joining us on the phone is Valerie Bassett, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts. Valerie Bassett, welcome to The Point.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
You work with economically disadvantaged women, oftentimes single mothers, trying to find a livable wage. Does feminism mean anything to these people?
Absolutely. But again, we or they might not always call it feminism. I think if we look to women and people working on issues of economic equity, there's a lot of leadership there, and where feminism as a movement and feminist organizations prioritize work for economic equity, focusing on low-income women, working women, then we have a real alliance and feminism has meaning. I think people identify with feminism or womanism, which is a term often used by women of color, when they're positively connected to that culture. But so I think for us, feminism is being in solidarity with all women, and in particular, working to create economic opportunity for women who don't have it. So I would say applied feminism is meaningful to those women when it prioritizes those issues.
And that really does seem to be a perception and maybe a reality that feminism has kind of focused on these questions of the CEOs. You know, I played a piece of tape earlier in the hour of a criticism of a CEO. She makes millions and millions of dollars a year. Does feminism have a classism problem?
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a long history in the women's rights movement of, the same divisions that challenge us as a society, challenging women working together by race and ethnicity and class and sexual identity and orientation. So these are things that women have been working on over time in the whole movement around intersectionality, really being mindful of working together and in alliance and solidarity across differences. So I do think where you have organizations working together on living wage, on universal child care or access to affordable child care, paid family and medical leave, affordable higher education, the whole movement around domestic workers' rights, these are things that can really unite us when we really think about class and think about economic opportunity. You know, women are disproportionately represented in minimum wage jobs, in low-paying caretaking jobs, and doing caretaking work. So I think that has the opportunity to really bring us together to make these changes. And it's happening. It's happening. There are a lot of women working on these alliances and these issues.
Angelique Rocher of the Ms. Foundation, is your foundation working in this area too?
Absolutely. Every single one of our organizations work with low-wage women, women of color, and immigrant women, specifically on the issues that have been brought up. And we're talking about reproductive justice, economic justice, and ironically, we just released a new child care report that very much hits on this. It talks about the changing demographics of our country and how when welfare reform happened, when the child care system was set up, we had a very different America. We had a very different system, and there was a lot of focus on the workplace, but there was not a lot of focus on non-traditional jobs. There was not a lot of focus on the sticky floor, talking about those folks who are actually caregivers, who are actually working jobs that don't allow for paid sick days, who don't allow for time off or leave, and are they are not even making enough money for them to be able to take advantage of the subsidies because of the way the child care system is set up. And so we are very, very, very much intimately, and it was one of the reasons why the Ms. Foundation was founded, was to ensure that women in their communities who are dealing with these type of issues, who are looking to have simple access to health care, who are trying to be treated with respect and dignity in parenting, but also trying to maximize economic opportunities and, you know, not having to deal with questions of, I can't even take the raise to make more money because the moment I take the raise to make more money, I'm no longer able to take advantage of the child subsidy system because now I've managed my way out of it and I can't even afford to go to work now because I can't afford child care. You know, we have a system now of low-income women who are subsidizing low-income women, and that really needs a lot of public support. And on the hierarchy of needs, that really comes first.
866-999-4626 to join the conversation. Susan is joining us from Edgartown. Susan, welcome to The Point.
Thank you. Hi. I just was so happy you brought up about the class system that nobody ever talks about, it seems, in this country. And I'm a baby boomer, so when I was growing up, I was an ultra-feminist because I was a hippie, too, you know, but I... to me, that meant being independent and being on my own and not falling into, at that time, the family values were kind of falling away in society. And I, you know, I'm in my 60s now. So I actually, even though I never had the interest in being married, I actually, you know, got stupid for a while and got married for about 15 years. And while I was married, I was so... happy to have it a little easier once my husband got a good enough job. But then when I divorced, I found that it was just so disgusting to see how, having seen the other side for a while, now I just can't seem to ever get along with a man because it seems like the only men that I can be in a relationship with want to, you know, lean on me, and I'm ready for the other way around at this point, if you follow. So I'm just interested in that subject. I don't have any children, but I am, you know, single woman, but I always had my own business. I always, a self-employed artist, and it's such a struggle now because of the recession. It is just such a struggle just to maintain and keep my home, and, you know, but I married, but, you know, it just banks everything. Everything in society is geared to married women.
Married women. Let me put that to Valerie Bassett, because she's from the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts. Marriage and divorce. What impacts does the institution of marriage have on women's economic lives?
Well, it's huge. And I think looking bigger than marriage, we can think about kind of social norms and institutions and our whole economy and as well as kind of our social structures of relationships is really still based on the notion of a male breadwinner. With, you know, women's labor for childcare and caretaking and domestic work. You know, even though we've in reality come a long way, I still think there's an underlying norm that girls and women are acculturated with to expect to be able to rely on someone else's income, and that we don't have structures like universal child care, paid family medical leave set up to assume that women are going to be economically independent and part of the workforce. So, you know, and I certainly think, you know, marriage as a legal institution, you know, most of it grows out of thinking about economic protections for women relying on, you know, a husband economically. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of good to think about not only the income gap, but the wealth gap, you know, is something that women who are older really face because of the cumulative gap in not only wages, but, you know, retirement funds and other benefits. So I think it's a huge issue. And I think we really need to think about both of our structures and how we're raising girls and boys in terms of thinking about economic independence and what relationships are.
Yeah, because it still seems like, at least in this country, that the men see the women as security, as almost like the mommies, the ones who are going to take care of them and be there, you know. And so, you know, to fall into that role-playing at this, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work when you know you can be out there and having your career, or, you know, even if you're a mom. I don't know, to me it's outdated. It's just, seems like no one talks about that factor, so thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Susan from Edgartown calling in. And in studio, I have Brenda Lone Baker of Inner Ovation Coaching. And Brenda, do you ever have to advise someone not to get a divorce because of economic reasons? I mean, how has this impacted your clients?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really had that opportunity or happenstance happen. But what I was thinking as I was listening to everyone speak was, you know, there's some great models that are happening now. If I look around the people that I know and the people that I am coaching, there's a lot more partnership happening, whether that's male, female, or whatever that looks like. A lot of families now, both people in the partnership have to work. And so there's a lot more sharing of tasks. There's a lot more sharing of monetary issues. And one of the things that I think people still, I've found working with a lot of women that we still take on a lot of the worry and the responsibility for everything that has to happen. And so I think that's a place we can grow, is the sharing of those responsibilities internally as well in the partnerships.
One item that I haven't brought up yet about the Washington Post Kaiser poll, it asked a question about whether women are held back by choices that they themselves make versus discrimination against women. And it was evenly split. It was 44% of the people responding say choices women make themselves. Actually, this was women asked this question. 44% of women say the choices women make themselves hold them back. And then 44% say that discrimination against women holds them back. And the rest of the respondents said either both or no opinion. Valerie Bassett, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it falls along lines of whether people look to kind of, you know, which is stronger, internal kind of individual responsibility or social factors. And, you know, you see different sort of political divisions along that line and just sort of personal temperaments and philosophies. I mean, I would definitely say individuals don't exist in a vacuum. So it's absolutely both. And the decisions that women make are made in the context of what opportunities they have, what they've learned, what they see other women doing. So I don't think it's sort of, I wouldn't put the blame only in either place. I would say, you know, we exist as a kind of organism within this larger ecosystem, and we've got to change both. And
yeah. We've been talking with Valerie Bassett, Executive Director of the Women's Fund of Southeastern Massachusetts, Angelique Roche of the Ms. Foundation, and Mary Lone Baker of Inner Ovation. Thanks so much to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mindy Todd will be back next week. I'm Elsa Partan. Thanks for listening.